First case in our calendar is 9684, Goldberg Companies, Inc. versus Council of the City of Richmond. Richmond Heights, excuse me, Mr. Burns.
Court, please. We just like to reserve 5 minutes.
Watch your time on the clock there.
It's always an honor and a privilege to come to this court. And it's particularly so today because the subject of this argument affects fundamental constitutional right and is of vital interest to everyone in the state.
The majority of your brief covers the 10-to-1 problem. We received, as you know, the additional information and motion to dismiss on the basis the City Council has now taken care of the 10-to-1 problem. You respond saying that does not moot our case because we still have the underlying issue to decide. Is that accurate so far?
That is completely accurate.
Then, is it your position that the 10-to-1 problem was the only thing that held up the approval of your zoning request?
I say that because with regard to approval of the site plan, the city raised other issues, as far as we're concerned, are not substantive. They were other methods to try and stop this development. They were legal and factual basis.
Well, but we never really have, do we, in effect, a final order from an administrative tribunal turning you down on the merits?
I believe we do. I'm sorry, Justice Douglas, did you say the administrative or?
Administrative.
Yes. We do have an administrative tribunal that turned this down on all cases.
But they based it principally on the 10-to-1.
Council has, there are two resolutions that were enacted by council. The city council denied the variance, and they also denied the site plan, and they did so for different reasons. So there is a definitive determination by the city council of Richmond Heights. One, variance should not have been granted, and they reversed the decision for the zoning appeals. The site plan did not meet their code requirements, and they reversed the recommendation of the planning commission.
Yeah, I remember that being the factual history, but I thought they premised mostly their rejection on the 10-to-1 issue.
The council's rejection on the site plan was both because it did not meet their parking requirements, also because they claimed that the proposed shopping plaza did not, I can't say the front of Major Street, because you can see that it had entrances on a side street, which while their ordinance did not prohibit it, they turned it down for that reason. They turned it down because they believed that a 60,000 square foot shopping plaza was not what they considered to be a neighborhood.
So do we have in the record a definitive enough statement from the city as to why, other than the 10-to-1, your zoning application should not be approved? And it would be, would it be that we're reviewing? Did the trial court review that?
The trial court spent little time on the site plan.
That's what my point is.
The arguments were all made, the evidence was all presented, but at every stage of the decisions of the court below, their decisions premised them almost entirely upon the 10-to-1.
Okay, that's what I thought, and that's why I went to that. So my final question is, if we reverse what happens, if we affirm what happens?
That's one of the prohibitions of this court. This court has before the entire record, and we have argued the site plan issues in our briefings we did in the court below. We don't think that there is any issue with respect
how do you see, Mr. Burns, the effect of the now changed zoning so that the parking 10-to-1 is even less relevant in that it's now B2?
Justice Cook, let me say this. It was never, the 10-to-1 parking ratio was never really the issue. I should have addressed that to Justice Douglas's question. There was never any issues in whether or not.
They didn't want a Mark's there.
Right.
They didn't want a Mark's store there. Is that what it
was?
Well,
that was really it. But even after the Mark's store withdrew, they continued their opposition. But the 10-to-1 parking ratio, there was never any evidence. You will not find one word in the brief in this court in which the city says the 10-to-1 parking ratio is reasonable. They defended it solely on the basis of this court's decisions in Columbia, Carsh's, Jerry Joe. No other basis for the brief in the trial court, the court of appeals, this court. That has been their position. Yes. It may be that it isn't reasonable, but if it isn't reasonable, you have no remedy because you cannot show that you
brought. But now, but the reasonableness was, that arose, the unreasonableness arose out of the 10-to-1.
That's correct.
And what we are faced with now, and Justice Douglas's question is the same as mine, and that is, if we were to reverse, Your pending plan would be apparently rejectable on another basis, and that is that there's only, now it wouldn't fit the B2 zoning.
All right, if that's the question, the easy answer to that is the decisions of this court, Fairmont Center and other cases, squarely hold that if you have an application that is pending, and the application is a lawful application, it's a lawful use, the subsequent change in zone cannot destroy that use. So we are, at this point, we have a vested right to build that which was lawful at the time we filed our application. By the way, we have both an application for site plan approval, and we have made an application for building permit. So that we've done all the things that we were supposed to do. A great expense.
Council doesn't very often get the opportunity to comment on improvidently allowed cases, but I'm wondering if since this piece, you know, I didn't vote to bring the case in, and I'm wondering even more what it is we could write on the law in this case that with, given the new factual situation or status of the case, that would be helpful to the bench and the bar. Is there still, can we still write on the issue in your first proposition of law, do you believe?
Justice Meyer, if this court were to determine, as the city would like it to, this matter is moot, then the decisions of the Conference Court and the Court of Appeals would become final orders. Those orders both rejected or affirmed the rejection of the site plan. We would then be in a position where we would lose the zoning. They would have been successful. They would have premised what they're doing on a wholly and completely arbitrary and unlawful ordinance, and then they would have been successful simply in changing it on the eve of a hearing, so that we could not build what we're going to build because our zoning would have lapsed. Only if this court were to reverse, and only if then our site plan is determined proper, are we in a position to receive any relief, because then that vested interest that we have would allow us to build what we have a lawful right to build in the end. So that I think the issues, the exact issues that were presented to this court before the change of zoning are exactly the issues which need to be determined. They're very much aligned.
What does the change in zoning allow you to build? Because when I read the motion to dismiss, I thought it allowed you to build what you really want to build, and they made the concessions which in
various
situations,
you allow them to settle this. They changed the zoning to the OS district. It's office buildings and certain other uses. It's not retail stores. That is the previous zoning that was in this project. That was not the
did you submit a reapplication for a new project there?
No.
you're claiming that even though they've taken out the 10 to 1 ratio on parking, it still not going to let you build the shopping center you want to build?
Well, there's no question about it. This was a marvelous way to avoid both the decision in this court and to thwart any opportunities for loaning.
If we have interpreted, if we interpret today the Guerrero case and the Columbia Oldsmobile case as we've previously interpreted them, do you lose?
That's correct.
So you want those clarified or overruled?
In the court's discretion, one or the other. It's our view that this court did not attempt two-pronged test to apply to area regulations. Despite the protestations of the city that you could never have a situation in which a municipality could enact this kind of ordinance that is arbitrary and then refuse a variance in a court that would not even believe that's exactly what's happened.
How does your area regulation argument differ from the substance of either one or both of those cases?
Only to this extent, Your Honor, in those cases, this court specifically addressed use classifications. I don't know what this court intended, but in all of those cases, in each one of them, the issue was the use classification. But let me answer the court's other question, Justice Douglas. We ask at the very least that an exception be drawn to those two-prong tests with regard to area regulations. That is, those matters not related to the personal use of the property.
Neither of those cases addressed area regulations, as you stated. They were use cases.
That's right.
And that's really what you're seeking for us to do, is to clarify it and determine whether they do in fact apply to area regulation.
That is certainly our first mission. Our second mission is to ask the court to look once again at the two-pronged test to determine whether, in the light of the facts in this case,
excessively or extensively?
Excessively. What remedy does a landowner have in this circumstance? There is no question that you've got an arbitrary ordinance. The remedies that may be available are a variance, and we say that we're entitled to a variance in this case. Why? Because, keep in mind that Duncan lays out seven non-exclusive criteria. You also, however, have a municipality, as almost every municipality has, their own criteria. And interestingly, Duncan may not have much effect when you're dealing with a municipality that has itself defined what those terms mean. We think we fit under both Duncan because there's no reason to list those ordinance, and as well, we think that we fit under their variance procedure because while they say that the variance that's requested must not apply to all properties, the situation must be municipal property. We've got a piece of property that's got $100,000 worth of trees right next to the residential area. That's unique. Not every property has that. In many circumstances, boards of zoning appeals have such limited powers. There isn't sometimes none at all in this state. But there may not even be a possibility of a variance, which creates an interesting circumstance, and that is the only thing you can do there is to attack the constitutionality of the ordinance. We do both these things. And as far as the constitutional validity of the ordinance is concerned, we understand that this court Board of Zoning Appeals. No court does. But this, a change in the two prong test, the change to what we believe is the law in federal courts, would not open the floodgates. 40% of my practice for the last 25 years has been in this area of practice. There aren't a lot of cases that reach this court or even a trial. Keep in mind, we've been 5 years in this process. It's an expensive process. Most people who want to develop property can't afford even the time or the expense, because by the time they get a result that may be beneficial, they've lost the opportunity to the economic opportunity to develop property. So there isn't that kind of number of cases.
Mr. Burke, I know your time's up, and I wanted to clarify what Justice Resnick asked. Are you seeking a limited revision of Jericho for purposes of area variance, or are you, as I understand it, saying that that test ought to be in the disjunctive for all zoning cases?
Your Honor, we're seeking at the very least.
Yeah, I know that.
An exception to the two-prong test. Our position has been, of course, below, and is here, that we believe that the conjunctive test that's used is not a proper test. We believe that it is variance. The earlier decisions of this court, one doesn't have to go that far to the normal well in 1977. We believe that it is not consistent with the decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States.
You've used your time, Mr. Burke. Thank you. Mr. Hunt.
Ratio by ordinance of the city council have anything to do with this case at all and its pending hearing?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't want to get into legislative intent.
I do. Because that's one of the things that
it may have
council sometimes do.
But I do want to say that ordinance has been in place since 1972. Mm-hmm. Times change in 25 years. In 1972, there was a real emphasis on paving, having lots of parking. That may not be the emphasis today in the legislature and local government.
It wasn't 5 years ago either.
Probably not.
But it just happened a week or 2 weeks before this hearing.
Well, this was something that was in the process long before that and came to a head 3 weeks before this hearing.
How do you think that action of the council moots this case? Because I recognize it was argued on the 10-1. That's why I was asking him. But also, wasn't there a negative response to the overall underlying zoning application?
There was a negative response to the site plan, because the council held that the site plan did not meet the B1 neighborhood zoning restrictions that are in the code, that more properly fit this rather large retail shopping complex fit in a regional business category, which is our B2 zoning category. And the B1 neighborhood facility was specifically set up to serve persons in adjacent residential areas. And I've cited in my brief and in the supplement to the record many facts that were derived from not only the city's hearings on this, but also the common police court trial on this, that this was designed to serve areas outside the city of Richmond on almost a regional basis, particularly the large 30,000 square foot retail store that was part of that complex.
Okay, that may be their intention. They deny that, of course. That may be their intention. But can you tell me specifically one or two criteria in the B2 zoning that this violates?
In the B1 zoning?
The B1 zoning. The existing zoning, when they made their application.
The specific criteria is that it needs to serve, this is the most critical, persons in adjacent residential areas only.
Isn't that a malleable, subjective, amorphous kind of thing? How do we know? Are we going to take a survey to find out if they're going to come from East Cleveland as opposed to next door to the shopping center? I mean, we never would know that.
The second issue is to be located on one major thoroughfare. B2 is on two major thoroughfares. Here we have a shopping complex, a large shopping complex, where all the entrance and exit is onto a small residential street where there are lots of residential developments right behind it. The testimony in the record was that all truck traffic would go in and out for deliveries as well as all patron traffic.
I guess that's my one of my reasons for wondering why this case is still significant to us. Why should we be deciding whether businesses are appropriate for the neighborhood or regional, or whether the access is complies with the zoning? That's a local issue. It's a decision.
I certainly agree with that. That's something that in a 2506 appeal that the courts have to give deference to the city's
Mr. Burns' suggestion that, urging that Guerrillo ought to be clarified or overruled, or at least ought to be rewritten in some way. How does that argument apply to what is left of this case?
Well, none of that applies to what's left to this case, because the issue raised under the Jericho two-prong argument that the public have raised, both limited to area regulations, use regulations, and want to expand it to also use regulations, has no application to the cases that sit there now, because the only ordinance that was challenged was the 10 parking spaces per 1,000 usable floor area for retail uses. There's no reason to get into the whole issue of whether or not the two-prong test applies in this particular case. And I would submit that it should not, the court should not carve out an exception for area regulations. It really doesn't make sense. Those types of regulations, as you undoubtedly are aware, do affect the character of the neighborhood, particularly issues such as density, even off-street parking regulations. You don't have enough parking. Anyone who's lived close to a school or a university knows that students often park on residential streets and tie up traffic. The same could be true if you did not have adequate parking in a retail complex.
Council, since you're here and this case is here and you're knowledgeable in your practice, could you answer the question I put in the dissent of Giorgio? How can lay me out a fact pattern under which the landowner could win when we conjunct the test?
It certainly happened in at least one lower court with an area regulation or setback regulation. I cited in my brief the Chimbrome versus the City of Aurora case, for example. That was a lot of setbacks were so great by the ordinance that it effectively did not permit any enough room for development. court did find it was unconstitutional as applied to that situation. So it certainly can come up. And I'd also like to say that the appellant's reliance on the federal cases, I think, is a little bit stretching. It's because if you read those cases, they do use the word order. But if you go beyond that initial proclamation of what the law of the court has been over the years, and they use the word order, but I think it's essentially almost an oversight. Because when you read the analysis of those cases, the primary cases relied upon by the appellant are the Welsh case, Hagen's, and Lucas. And when you read those cases, you will see that actually in the analysis, they do a two-part test. They certainly look at the economic viability of the property. They then go and look at whether or not there is a legitimate government interest which is advanced. It's explicit in all of those cases. And particularly Lucas involved setback regulation. Essentially, you cannot develop along the coastal part of South Carolina in these areas. Of course, we remanded that case back to the state court. It was a total confiscation case on the first call. They said to the state court, please determine whether this statute is a legitimate governmental interest based on common law nuisance principles and what they call the old harmful, noxious use analysis. If you look at Hagen's, another case, it specifically says that assessing the fairness of the zoning ordinance, and in that case it was a density regulation, that these benefits, the benefits of that density regulation, of course, were less dense residential development of open spaces. These benefits must be considered.
You would agree with counsel then that even though you've changed the zoning ordinance from 10 to 1, this site plan would still not fit under your zoning.
That's correct.
But you're arguing that those other zoning regulations were not challenged on a constitutional basis.
That's correct.
So basically the mootness is that only the constitutional challenge to the two-prong test has been mooted by passing the regulation. And what we're basically down to is simply a review of the reasonableness of the zoning positions.
Exactly. B1 commercial versus the B2. I think with that I will close.
Counsel, in Hagen's, didn't the court say the application of a general zoning law to a particular property affects a taking if the ordinance does not substantially advance legitimate state interests or denies an owner economically viable use of his land?
They were stating a legal principle from previous cases of the U.S. Supreme Court. If you read further in the analysis of that case, you will see that they actually did a two-part conjunctive analysis in that case. Specifically on page 262 of that opinion, it says, assessing the fairness of this zoning ordinance, this is actually a holding case, these benefits have been less density, or open space. These benefits must be considered along with any diminution in market value that the appellant can suffer. It's essentially a two-part test.
We have another case pending with this same issue, counsel, and I think it's that case where we've been cited to the criticism in law reviews of this two-part test. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Mr. Burns, you've used your time. So you may take 30 seconds for rebuttal.
First of all, I need to say that Williams was taking this case. It's not a case for this nature. In 30 seconds, I can say first that as far as the site plan is concerned, where the driveways are located is not the issue. The issue is what the ordinance requires. All
makes an error. That makes it an error case, doesn't it? Without the constitutional issue, with what's left, isn't it just a question of whether counsel erred? And we don't decide those cases generally.
No, right. That's okay. If we were entitled to either a variance or determination that this ordinance was unconstitutional, then perhaps dependent upon what a court would find with regard to the site plan, this court or lower court, we might still be able to build that shopping center. If this case were dismissed as moot, we would not ever be able to do it because of this court's decision, and among other cases, Rob, it would be raised judicata. We would never be able to go back and certainly build that shopping center. But that would be the greatest injustice in the entire world.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.